In the coming week, the United Nations holds its annual General Assembly debate. Canadians head to vote in a closely contested federal election. And President Biden hosts a summit addressing COVID-19. It's September 16th, 2021, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Stuart Patrick, sitting in for Jim Lindsay.
Stuart is CFR's James H. Binger Senior Fellow in Global Governance and directs the International Institutions and Global Governance Program at CFR. Stuart, it's great as always to have you back.
It's great to be back. Thanks a lot, Bob.
Well, let's kick it off with this annual big event, which is the UN General Assembly debate, where leaders of government, heads of state come and deal with the biggest issues of the day. It is COVID influenced, as it was last year, Stuart. Some people are going to be appearing in person, some virtually. Could you tell us a bit more about what to look for at UNGA this year, Stuart?
Well, first of all, I'd say that the atmospherics are going to be a lot different than they were over the past 4 years, at least when it comes to the United States. You know, the U.S. is now back in the multilateral fold. The president and a lot of his senior officials have been repeating this sort of ad nauseum. America is back. Multilateralism is back. Diplomacy is back, etc. And I think that what we're going to see from the president is an opportunity really for him to drive home this message globally. But as always, you know, the president's going to be speaking to two audiences, right? So, you know, the challenge on the international front is to persuade the world, which has been kind of whipsawed by the U.S. orientation over the last several years, that the U.S. is back for good. And then for the American audience, I think the important thing there is going to be convincing or persuading his listeners that he can reject placing America first while still placing Americans first. And I think that's really what the foreign policy for the middle class that the administration's been touting is really all about. You know, as for the speech itself and what we can expect from the president, according to conversations with U.S. officials and press reports, it seems like it's probably going to focus on three or four themes. The pandemic, of course, climate change, the defense of democracy, and I would suspect some mention of Afghanistan.
Yeah, so that's a big lineup. I'd like to touch on the last one first, Stuart, Afghanistan, because you mentioned multilateralism is back as a big Biden theme. But I think his administration has taken some knocks, not only domestically, but internationally for what has transpired in Afghanistan with the withdrawal, which was by a number of accounts not heavily coordinated with U.S. allies when it was announced. And then the rapid pace of summer events left a big scramble, and the world's still kind of dealing with the fallout in terms of what to do with Afghans who could be refugees and so forth. You have some also resentment, I think, on the COVID question too. But let's start with Afghanistan, Stuart. What kind of messaging you think he's going to say, and how does he need to calibrate that?
You know, you're absolutely right. This is a really tricky topic for the president. And you know, I mentioned before that the United States had returned to the multilateral fold. And I probably should have parenthetically said for the most part, right? Because right. You know, I think that particularly close European allies that have been involved in the NATO mission there since basically the United States invaded, I think many of them were quite taken aback by this speed and lack of coordination that the United States demonstrated. And, you know, it was a shambolic departure, I think, by, you know, sort of any reasonable accounting would suggest that that this was not the administration's finest hour, the U.S.'s finest hour, regardless of what one thinks about the merits of actually leaving Afghanistan. So, you know, the United States, you know, has very little leverage right now in Afghanistan. We don't have a presence on the ground and a military or diplomatic. But at the same time, the United States obviously has an interest, both a humanitarian interest in making sure that people don't starve to death in Afghanistan. And frankly, it appears that, you know, a million children, for instance, are at risk of doing so, much less adults in Afghanistan. And so there needs to be some effort to try to bring at least some emergency relief to a country that's really in economic freefall. And there needs to be some sort of international presence to help a political process there and also to monitor what the Taliban are doing. And so both of those things are going to be, I think, the things that President Biden is going to stress and hopefully encourage. Now, there have been a few steps along those lines. There was a big pledging conference earlier this week in Geneva, which you know, mobilized about $1 billion, and then you know there's hope of extending the United Nations assistance missions in Afghanistan, notwithstanding the Taliban takeover.
Stuart, another of the big issues is climate. That certainly is an area where there's a clear line of difference between the Biden and Trump administrations. And we've gotten signals that other countries are probably going to raise this as well, certainly as you have a very big global climate conference looming in Glasgow and another summer of intense extreme weather incidents. What do you think we're going to hear from Biden or other leaders on that front?
Well, I think we're going to hear certainly from Boris Johnson, who's going to be the Prime Minister of Britain, who's going to be hosting the Glasgow Climate Change Summit. That's probably going to be the vast bulk of the remarks that he delivers from the podium. But when the president speaks on Tuesday, climate change will be a huge theme. The president has accepted the phraseology of Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, that the world faces a code red. Those are remarks he made when he visited New Jersey in the aftermath of the torrential rains and flooding in Hurricane Ida. This has been a major theme of the Biden administration. Obviously hosted a big summit on Earth Day to try to drive home the need for major emissions reductions. This is the message that Special Envoy John Kerry has been making in his meetings with the Chinese and others, that they really need to accelerate decarbonization. So I think there's going to be a call by the president that the world really needs to accelerate the timetable. He'll be touting U.S. contributions in this area. The promise to cut basically emissions in half by 2030, reforming the U.S. electricity grid, electrifying the U.S. auto fleet. The big difficulty that the president's going to encounter, of course, is that the two major pieces of legislation which allow him to do this, which are basically the infrastructure bill and then the budget reconciliation bill, remain, their outcome and their fate remains, in the hands of a couple of U.S. senators. And it's questionable as to whether or not the president's going to get what he needs to prove the U.S. bona fides when it comes to climate change.
That's a good point, Stuart. And I think kind of the spectacle of U.S. democracy might be a bit of a subtext of what world leaders are looking at and interested in as they either come in person or they gauge Biden's comments, right? Because it's the U.S. itself, which feels like it's never been more divided, and the very holding of elections in the U.S. continues to be challenged. What do you think is the burden that Biden has in terms of presenting his democracy-focused remarks, and how credible do you think they'll be?
Yeah, I mean, you point to a real dilemma for the president. The president has described the struggle between democracy and autocracies, the defining clash of our age. You know, he can be expected to certainly, in his remarks, castigate China and Russia for undermining democratic values and universal standards of human rights. At the same time, he's going to have to acknowledge that, there's a lot of authoritarian tendencies around the world, including, he might even say, within our own country, at least in, I think, a lot of the way certainly Democrats see aspects of the Republican Party, and certainly the still most influential figure in the Republican Party, Donald Trump. So he'll undoubtedly say that he's going to still hold this summit for democracy, an idea which is met with a certain amount of skepticism, given the questionable credibility of the United States to hold this. And I think that the way he's going to try to square the circle is to say, look, democracy is a work in progress, as you've seen in the United States, and we're still trying to craft a more perfect union almost 250 years after we were founded. But it's time to rally some forces and, play defense and maybe even a little offense against some of these trends.
And as always, the UN, there's always the unexpected or the outspoken comments that came as a surprise or whatever. So lots of spectacle to look forward to next week.
Yes, absolutely. But there's always a lot of some unexpected events that occur. And well, the UN General Assembly is not the only excitement that's going to occur next week. If we just look north of the border from the United States, our neighbor Canada is holding a really important election this coming week. Canadians are getting ready to head for the polls to vote in a contentious federal election. This is a snap election. It was called last month by current Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who's been in office for 6 years now. And his hope is to try to turn public approval of his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic into a fresh four-year mandate. Bob, you've been looking at this. What do we need to know ahead of this election in Canada?
Well, first, Stuart, let me just take a pause and admire a major democracy's ability to turn around a general election in 5 weeks' time, given the draining marathon we just went through in the U.S. for the leadership elections. That promises only get longer, as we look at the U.S. calendar. But I don't want to dwell on that. So let's talk about the way you set this up, Stuart, which is, what is Justin Trudeau trying to do, and what's the kind of the mood in Canada? And by much of what I've seen and observed and even heard from Canadians I know, Canada is feeling a bit feisty, shall we say, right now about its leadership. Justin Trudeau has seemed to have taken a very risky move here, and according to some critics, has made the pandemic policy, which had not been quite so contentious and divisive, into a very divisive issue in Canada. Now, we should note, by way of comparison, the U.S. continues to be frustrated by a very strong minority or vocal minority against taking vaccines, and it's posed all sorts of problems in the U.S. Canada's got something like 75% vaccination rate, was trailing the US at one point and then surged ahead. You do have some sort of sense of common purpose there. However, you do have a minority there that strongly resists any sort of vaccine mandates that Trudeau has signaled he's going to institute. And so you had even the extraordinary spectacle of one appearance, the prime minister had gravel thrown at him by angry protesters. He's faced other threats at other points on the campaign trail, such that a number of Canadians have just said they've never seen anything like this in terms of the virulence of the opposition on this issue. And so his kind of calculation that he could call this election at this time to get into he's running a minority government, I should note, and he's hoping to get a majority and get the country behind him to put in place policies that will keep the country sound and safe and focused on its health care well into the future beyond this, hopefully this pandemic, and to take on others. So that's not clear whether that's going to happen. He's running neck and neck with Erin O'Toole, who heads the Conservatives. And O'Toole is, while he's generally supported sort of common policies on vaccinations, has not been in support of the strict mandates. Otherwise, though, has run a fairly centrist campaign by most accounts. Canada's Conservatives, they don't deny climate change, human-caused climate change. And in fact, he's supporting the very least Canada's original commitment to the Paris Climate Agreement of 6 years ago. While climate is going to be a very interesting topic, though, to see how it plays across the spectrum. Canada has other major parties, including a Green Party that has just a few seats in Parliament, that is going to be making a lot about the recent extreme weather events, including in Western Canada this past summer, extraordinary heat tolls being taken, fires that actually erased one town, the town of Lytton, from the map, basically. And just real concern about the country's kind of energy policy. Canada has been a major fossil fuel creator. Fossil fuels continue to have an important political constituency as well, Stuart. So you have these big events playing out. It is a liberal conservative struggle, but you also have parties like the New Democrats, which are leftist. You have the Greens, and you also have a far right party that's more sort of blood and soil nationalist that are looking to get some gains in this kind of angry environment.
That's a really extraordinary summary about a really complicated political landscape. You know, anytime you try to call a snap election, it is a risky proposition, particularly given the speed of the news cycle. What looks good at one stage becomes more problematic. And I know that Canada sort of, you know, as in other places, you know, experiencing sort of a fourth wave, right, of this pandemic, and change the political landscape really quickly. And of course, no longer the fresh face after 6 years. And obviously, the prime minister has a record to run on. From what you're saying, it really sounds like, and given the presence of these other parties, it sounds like there's a pretty good chance that the prime minister could end up right back where he started, which is perhaps maybe eking out a victory over the Conservatives, but still at the helm of a minority government and without a whole lot to show in terms of a major mandate from this electioneering.
That seems to be the betting, Stuart, from the Canada Watch, as you say. At the end of the day, Trudeau will not gain the sweeping majority that he seeks, but will eke out just enough support for his own Liberals, who, by the way, have been a dominant party over the past century in Canada. There have been a few periods where Conservatives have held sway in government, but Liberals, by and large, the country tends to swing back to them over time. But instead, it's going to be this potentially interesting coalition. You have this, as I said, the leftist New Democratic Party, which is led by Jagmeet Singh, a Sikh, and he himself is polls as one of the most popular individual party leaders in the country. You have the Parti Québécois, which, as always, is very much for asserting Quebec's rights as a French-speaking province and trying to protect its Frenchness, so to speak. And then you have the major two parties kind of duking it out, as always. And again, Canadian politics sometimes are compared to the U.S., but they're really different in a whole host of areas. And at the end of the day, whether or not it comes out the way you mentioned, Stuart, as a sort of a status quo result, or even if the Conservatives take over, the betting by some is that you will not see a major sea change in Canadian policy, you know, with either result, with a minority Conservative government, for example, or a minority Liberal government.
That's fascinating. Yeah, so I guess what you're suggesting, at least in part, is something of a steady state in policy, at least in terms of foreign policy outlook on the part of Canada. It's a fascinating, very pluralist country, and one that has become more diverse over time. And you see that in some of the leadership of some of the major parties. Here's hoping that the Canadians, although they borrow many things from us, just like we borrow their comedians, here's hoping that some of the vitriol that has accompanied this election, particularly with respect to the pandemic, doesn't prove as long-lasting and as divisive as it appears to be in the United States, at least for the time being.
Yes, we need our models these days, Stuart. So we're hoping for a Canadian model for the way forward. And we'd also like to see, by the way, the U.S. open up its border to Canadians. As our colleague Ted Alden has been repeatedly writing about, it still remains kind of a one-way street at this point.
Yes, indeed. And my I've been hoping for a visit from my younger brother who lives in New Brunswick in Fredericton. So that would be great for me too as well.
Well, Stuart, we're going to stick with the theme of symmetry on the podcast, though, and come back to what's going to be playing out next week, next to or adjacent to the UN General Assembly. President Biden is planning to host a summit called the Global COVID-19 Summit, Ending the Pandemic and Building Back Better. His invitation to the world leaders also includes an appeal to heads of international organizations, businesses, philanthropic organizations, NGOs, and so forth to commit to ending the COVID-19 pandemic. So what's on the agenda for these talks, Stuart?
The primary purpose of this virtual meeting is really to improve global access to vaccines and treatments, as well as accelerate their production. And this is particularly poignant and pressing for the world's poorest countries. You know, as you know, the overwhelming number of vaccine shots administered today, about 80% of them, have been administered in high and upper middle income countries. So basically, the wealthy gated communities of the world. Meanwhile, only about 2% of folks who live in the poorest category of countries have even gotten one shot. There's a huge inequity here. You know, and just this January, the beginning of the year, the Director General of the WHO warned in his words, that the world was courting a moral catastrophe. And I think that's what a lot of people are seeing right now when they see this level of inequity. It's not only unfair in a sort of a justice perspective, but it's also counterproductive because, you know, what epidemiologists tell us is that the failure to vaccinate the rest of the world actually allows these new variants to emerge and simply prolongs the pandemic and the economic and political fallout that sort of attends to it. So not expanding vaccine access is really being penny wise and dollar foolish. So President Biden, like many other Western leaders, has come under a certain amount of criticism, right, for ignoring the plight of the world's poor. And you see this in the huge debate over booster shots, right? Which is supposedly the FDA may be on the verge of, other U.S. agencies on the verge of actually approving. But the question is, why should these booster shots, which for most people might be of sort of only marginal utility, be going to, you know, Americans and Europeans when they might be going to save lives in the developing world? So the summit, from this angle, is sort of President Biden's chance to get on the right side of history, if you think about it that way. So, in terms of the actual goals of the event from the U.S. perspective, I mean, the president is hoping to persuade the leaders that are going to be attending this to commit to the target of vaccinating 70% of the world's population, not just in general, but across all income categories. And at the same time, the reason that some of the why there's outreach not just to NGOs but to the private sector is that there's going to be a major effort to try to lay the basis for expanded production capacity, including in the developing world and emerging economies, as well as sort of more efficient supply chains. The final element that that the president seems to be pushing, according to some leaked documents, is the creation of what he envisions as a standing global health threats council at the level of heads of state. And this is an interesting proposal that the independent panel on pandemic preparedness and response actually suggested. And so it's interesting to see the Biden administration move in this direction. Actually, CFR's own task force on preparing for the next pandemic, which I helped to co-direct, actually made a similar suggestion as well, that there be, you know, a standing high-level body that could spring into action, frankly, when the world faces another pandemic.
It makes so much sense. And by the way, I recommend listeners to take a look at that task force report, which really holds up well. And Stuart, your work with Tom Boyke was terrific on that. But it does make so much sense. He's set up this type of infrastructure, but also, you know, for the U.S. to work across all the frictions with China to try to get China really engaged in this. There continue to obviously to be all sorts of tensions about the origins of COVID. And the WHO itself has not come down conclusively, but has not said China was not the origin of it or Wuhan was not the origin of it. But it also seems to me like this, just looking at it in kind of a realpolitik way, Stuart. What a giant missed opportunity. You have the United States in particular, which has created most of what are seen as the gold standard in vaccines and is awash in these vaccines and can't get more than, say, 53% of its own country, you know, totally vaccinated against COVID, is kind of just here and there, you know, releasing certain doses of it or boosting supplies in certain areas, but has not yet taken advantage of the ability to just show the world, look, this is what a free society can create with the right motivation and everything. everything else. China came under criticism for, you know, using kind of vaccine leverage in terms of delivering its vaccine to certain countries. Its vaccine has not shown to be particularly effective, with has some levels of effectiveness. But the U.S. itself, you know, there was certainly prioritizing supplies to, say, let's say, the Quad members that it's now engaged in diplomatically in Mexico and here and there. But that figure that you cited at the outset, 2% in, you know, developing countries, is just staggering. And one hopes that this summit will lead to something really robust, especially coming from the U.S.
Yes, absolutely. You know, there's been a lot of talk about vaccine nationalism, as well as a lot of writing, including by Tom Boyke, my colleague who runs the CFR's Global Health Program. But we've also then seen vaccine diplomacy, and some of it's been kind of heavy-handed and clumsy, particularly on the part of the Chinese in particular, where they've, you know, a linkage to all sorts of other sort of policy requests to back Chinese positions in this and that. The U.S. has not been that clumsy, and it has tried to, I mean, it has pledged, you know, hundreds of millions of doses of vaccines. But what's interesting is there's been an effort to try to get some diplomatic mileage out of it. And I think what that's done, in a sense, is shortchange COVAX, which is this multilateral effort and multi-stakeholder effort to try to, you know, make this the world's fight, you know, to try to make vaccine access and equitable vaccine access, you know, a global public good, right? Because we're all in this together. And, you know, Martin Wolf of the Financial Times has written a number of excellent articles about how crazy it is for countries to pursue vaccine nationalism or even sort of a nationally focused vaccine diplomacy when a cooperative effort could really make things happen. And there's been a number of different international organizations, including the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, who've really stressed the importance of moving forward in a way that recognizes global interdependence and interconnections, frankly, that we have in an epidemiologically, you know, interdependent world.
No, it's a really good point, Stuart. And again, you need look no farther than previous global health efforts on vaccinations or, you know, efforts against Ebola or efforts against polio or whatever. Actually, there's a template for this and it works and it can be really effective, but it's become so loaded with all these other baggage right now. I'm looking forward to next week and seeing what comes out of it.
Well, Bob, we've reached the time to pivot and discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet to us at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected 216 million climate migrants. Why did our audience select this figure?
Stuart, I think our audience seized on the climate concern that's out there and the number that the World Bank produced in its what's called its groundswell report about you know, sort of modeling what could be some of the impacts of climate change by the middle of the century. And so by its sort of maximalist estimation, there could be migration up to 216 million people by 2030, and that would continue to spread by 2050 if, you know, action is not taken. And it mentions that sub-Saharan Africa is the most vulnerable region due to desertification and dependence on agriculture and so forth. So 86 million people in sub-Saharan Africa are projected to be moving within national borders as part of a worst case scenario. The best case scenario says, oh, well, it might just be, you know, something like 44 million people who are forced to leave their homes or communities or whatever. So we're still talking about human flight. We're already seeing it. I know you're familiar with this issue as well, and you've been focusing a lot on climate issues. It's basically another call to action. You mentioned the red alert to countries to try to get some of these net zero emissions policies sort of activated by mid-century.
Yeah, this is going to be an issue, I think, that's going to be with us for a while. A lot of the migrants are moving within their own countries as opposed to crossing borders. There's a tendency sometimes to refer to them as climate refugees. But, you know, it's an interesting category that doesn't really fit into traditional economic migrants or really refugees who are basically people who cross borders because they have a well-founded fear of persecution. But there's no question there's going to be a lot more of them, both internally displaced and globally. You know, 20 million Bangladeshis right now face saltwater intrusion into their drinking water, and 3.5 million have already fled the coast as a result of rising sea levels and of course, the periodic catastrophic storms that we see associated with climate change. So this is something that is going to be on the radar screen increasingly, and also on the radar screen of the United States. You know, President Biden earlier this year actually tasked U.S. government government agencies to come up with a policy for environmental migrants. And in the last few weeks, Refugees International actually came up with some really interesting proposals about how to deal with this. And it's not about opening the Refugee Convention, which would be a Pandora's box, I think, but it's really trying to see what kind of international instruments and also national policies can be directed at trying to, you know, deal with folks who, because they can't live where they have been anymore because of crop failure or water scarcity or sea level rise, are going to need to relocate. And how is the world, and in fact, the United States, going to be dealing with this issue? Even in the United States, some projections predict that millions of Americans are going to have to leave from particular areas due to heat, due to extreme weather, sea level rise, etc. So a huge adjustment and an entire new category of the displaced people, if you will.
Yeah, and Hurricane Ida, which you referenced earlier, Stuart, is, I think, providing, you know, fresh food for thought for especially coastal Americans, because it really stung, you know, from New Orleans all the way up to New Jersey and New York City. That's a huge swath of the country, and it seems like it's just another harbinger.
Yeah, absolutely. And our colleague Alice Hill, who has a new book out on lessons of the COVID-19 pandemic for cooperation, sometimes not good lessons, sometimes good lessons for climate change, has a lot to say about the failure of the United States, at least to date, to really prepare and develop the kind of resilience that the United States and the world need to cope with these extreme weather events and changing climate patterns to come.
And thanks again to our audience for picking another especially poignant figure of the week.
Well, so that's our look at the stormy world next week. Here are some other stories you might want to keep an eye on. The EU Med7 summit takes place on the island of Crete, and Huawei Connect 2021 kicks off in Shanghai.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also doubled as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks to Terrence Mullen and Anya Zeliniak for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons.
This is Stuart Patrick saying goodbye.
This is Bob McMahon saying, Stuart, thanks again for joining us, and so long and be well out there.